Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. It's Sunday night. We are having some minor technical difficulties. Don, if you're listening, I will be having you call in a minute. Tonight's topic is Saeed Qutb. He was born in 1906 in northern Egypt in a village called Musha and raised in a devout Muslim home. He memorized the Quran as a boy. Later he moved to Cairo and found work as a teacher and writer. His novels made no great impression, but he earned a reputation as an astute critic. Qutb was among the first champions of Naguib Malifuz, a young modern novelist. Anyways, he went on to become a theorist. And by the way, Don, the studio is shut down for a minute, so I gotta. I'm gonna play some music while I'm trying to get this to work. I'm real sorry. So basically, he ended up becoming the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was a major solidarity movement in the Middle East, which led to other movements like the Ba'ath Party in Syria and Iraq. And one of their themes was to create a society in which the Sharia law would be dominant, because he tried to overthrow Nasser in Egypt, which was a Western-based government, but he was unable to, and he was punished in prison for a period over 5 to 10 years, as well as one of his colleagues. So let me just play this part of this documentary that I have going up until I can pull my other co-hosts on the line. This is really upsetting that it's acting up this very minute. So hold on a second, please.
Allahu Akbar. God is great. The Muslim call to prayer, repeated 5 times a day in mosques all over the world. But this time, the call comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, with much of North Africa and the Middle East in flames. They are now a dominant voice. Every major government is watching them closely, wondering what they will do next.
The Muslim Brotherhood is like a closed box.
What does the Muslim Brotherhood want? Who are their members? Do they still have things to terrorism? At the moment, peaceful cooperation seems to be the public face the Muslim Brotherhood wants to project.
Democracy is the only way to solve our problem.
After almost 30 years of oppression, the people take to the streets to remove President Mubarak, a man they call a tyrant, who they believe looted the country of billions of dollars. The army in control, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the biggest power block in the country, Egypt, now faces its biggest challenge. Can the country have a peaceful revolution, become a democracy, and deliver peace to all Egyptians? After years in the wilderness, what will the Muslim Brotherhood do next?
I was able to bring the website up, and I'm going to pull John in now. John, 1 second here.
God.
I lost John and Don. If you're still holding, can you call back in? Oh, wait, I got John here, right here. Good evening, John. How's your night going?
Well, hello, Hammer. It's a little chilly-willy in Los Angeles, but not as chilly as where you're at, I'm sure.
It's not chilly here. It's 37 degrees, but it's still it's seasonably warm here. Now,
I
just do a quick intro before Don calls in? Oh, Don did call in.
Yeah.
Let's just say I don't really have time for small chitter-chatter right now, but let's get to the point. John, me and John are already on the line. The topic tonight is Saeed Qutb, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and I'm going to give a brief intro before letting you in. Saeed Qutb was, he was actually an intellectual who spent some time in Greeley, Colorado in the early 50s. And I will tell you some tidbits about that because it's rather funny. But he had a theological stance. He had a belief that in matters that cannot be seen, the imperceptible was an important sign of man's ability to accept knowledge from fields outside of science. This is one of his quotes. The concept of the imperceptible is a decisive factor in distinguishing man from animal. Materialist thinking, ancient as well as modern, has tended to drag man back to an irrational existence with no room for the spiritual, where everything is determined by sensory means alone. What is peddled as progressive thought is more of a dismal regression. So anyways, he was accused of trying to overthrow the Egyptian leader Nasser, and him and his Muslim Brotherhood group, which was a small organization, were tortured in prison from 54 to 64 by the... don't make background noise, please. I can't hear. They were tortured in prison from... John, are you at church?
No, but I'm actually walking between zones. I'm trying to get to a more quiet, secure area.
Okay, sorry. It's not that bad. They were thrown in prison for their for the accusation that they were going to overthrow Nasser, and it included torture and murder of Muslim brothers. And he was convinced after that only through Islamic law could governments be held in check. In other words, they didn't trust government authority alone. Now, we'll just start out with that concept, and I'll tell you why I'm doing the show this way tonight and why I'm focusing on Saeed Qutb. Let's say hi to Don first. Good evening, Don.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to snowy Reno, Nevada. Beautiful.
Well,
and
we have 2 inches in North Duluth, but 0 inches where I live.
No, you guys are in a heat wave, apparently. But that's good. That won't last. I'll wait a couple of days.
Well, John's not convinced that 37 is a heat wave.
Oh, it's a heat wave. But John lives in California, okay?
I know.
California.
John,
California.
Feel free to comment, John, on that.
Well, I would not survive in any of your temperatures. So, God, thank God that He gave us California, and I'm sure with you know, our Muslim brothers, He allowed that to happen on the planet. So, I guess we have to figure out how to coexist or how to survive and work through the issue of it. In other words, It's part of what is and what I have to deal with, you know, all of us. So I think it's a good subject.
Okay, the reason I'm doing it on this subject tonight, and I just want to mention 2 things. We're not going to get heavy-duty historical because we only have 35 minutes left. But what happened was the main origin for this thinking as I was watching, it reminded me, we did a show about a year ago with Bob Aldridge on some of the origins of Muslim thinking. And see, it didn't start out as a terrorist organization. It was a resistance organization that was fighting against imperial powers. And at that time, the U.S. and Britain, you know, they made deals with Egypt over that one Suez Canal. Both Truman and Eisenhower were involved. And also the Dulles brothers helped overthrow Mossadegh in Iraq. And, you know, back then it was called imperialism, and the Western powers were strong army in the Middle Eastern powers and, you know, subjugating their leaders. So it didn't start out as a you know, a one-man killer manhunt type organization. It started out as a noble cause. Now, can I just mention one thing, and then we can all get into a modern debate about what's going on now. In 1952, Egypt's pro-Western government was overthrown by the nationalist Free Officers Movement headed by Gamal Nasser. Both Qutb and the Muslim Brotherhood welcomed the coup against the monarchist government, which they saw as un-Islamic and subservient to British imperialism, enjoyed a close relationship with the movement. Once again, it's called the Free Officers Movement, that led to the coup. Nasser would go to the house of Said Qutb and ask him for ideas about the revolution. Many members of the Brotherhood expected Nasser to establish an Islamic government. However, the cooperation between the Brotherhood and Free Officers, which marked the revolution's success, soon became secular national ideology of Nasserism and was incompatible. Now, I'm not sure what Nasserism, but it's based on a socialist Arab national political ideology. Probably around that time, that's when Mossadegh started in the 50s, his nationalist government, when he took the British Petroleum away from the British and created a socialistic oil revenue sharing, which later got him under house arrest for life. So the only funny thing I was going to mention is that when Qutb visited Greeley, he went to a teacher's college as an exchange student in Greeley, Colorado. He was criticized America. He thought boxing was brutal. They had bad haircuts, superficial conversations. It was phony how they watered their lawns. And he also disapproved of women and men mixing of the sexes. Supposedly in Arab society, the sexes. He's not talking about sex. He's talking about men and women congregating together in public. And he also said that a lot of people in college had sex and that jazz was barbaric. So one article I read said that it was a lesson in hate, that this guy was just a cranky old Muslim and he didn't approve of anything, and he was the origin of all the hatred, which led to the violent jihad. So he called jazz this is the music of savage Bushmen created to satisfy their primitive desires. Now, one thing I notice about strict Muslims is they don't find anything enjoyable. Would you guys care to comment on some of the things I just said?
I'd like to hear Don's comments on this. I think he usually has some very good viewpoints.
Wow. Okay, we've got 5 minutes left for the show.
No, we have 35.
No, that was a joke. But anyway, one of the things that I get out of a lot of this is that these are principles that Qutb and his fellow Muslim Brotherhood founder, Hassan al-Banan, they believe that they're not trying to go backwards. They're trying to go forward. They actually believe that a Muslim Islam world leadership is going to keep people away from the greed. And the greed is circular because the greed is what got Islam started in the first place. So they don't want to go back to where it was before Islam became the world's moral religion. But this is all about proselytization too. And I've mentioned this before, most all religions are looking for the same thing. If you read an article and said this religion, religion X, believed in morality and believed in abstinence and believed in no isms and believed in God and believed in the family unit. If you said that you would be more or less portraying every purpose for every religion, so why aren't all the religions compatible? And that's a question.
Can I just say one thing? Because I'm going to throw in Rastafarianism too in this. At Cairo, Alexandria's in northern Egypt, and Cairo used to be the center for Muslim studies, and it was a very diverse region of intellectuals. It wasn't narrow. It wasn't just a bunch of narrow-minded Muslims. It was a centerpiece for Jews, Christians, and Muslims to learn. Now, how this guy, Saeed Qutb, got such narrow-minded thoughts, the one thing that did inspire me, though, is that the idea of spiritualism, you know, the belief that what man can't see, the imperceptible, the divine, is kind of goes along the lines of Plato and Aristotle.
I'm
just saying that, like, he had some kind of cosmic thinking that wasn't so rigid like the way the modern day jihadists are.
Right, and that's exactly what I'm saying, is that he does not want to go back to where there was ignorance. And what it is with his learning, his teachings from Greeley, Colorado, right there in the, you know, in the hotbed of secularism, you know, the Western culture. He learned that Western life was more or less the devil's life. There's a quote in here that I saw that was excellent. He said, "What should be our verdict on the synthetic Western civilization? What should be done about America and the West, given their overwhelming danger to humanity? Should we not issue a sentence of death? Is it not the verdict most appropriate to the nature of the crime?" You know, that was an interesting set of questions, because he does call Western civilization synthetic, and that is a very, very good description of how the West has been taken over and is being run to this day. It is synthetic. It's not real. People are ingesting toxins and non-foods, non-nutritious foods. Everything that's going in our financial system, our housing system, our banking system, everything that's going into everything is synthetic. It's not any longer human. So we've got to, that's the thing that he's trying to express. That was his hatred towards Western civilization, is that it is so synthetic. It is artificial.
I think the reason he had the proliferation of resentment towards Western civilization, it didn't start until that him and his friends got tortured by the Nasser regime, which ended up aligning with Western civilization and, you know, becoming phony. Now, he also
Go ahead. This was a kids' club that he joined to try to see if he could change the system. This was not originally any thought of him to go to a Muslim Brotherhood Islamism. You know, this
I don't even know if they called it the They didn't call it the Muslim Brotherhood. It was called that in the 50s, but when they first started it, he was just the editor of chief of a magazine called Al Ikhwan Muslimin, and then later headed up a different strain of that organization. It looks like you did some of your research.
Well, I when I'm unsure, because I've knew I've heard his name before in the past, but I was not. It was way back in my potential memory. So I knew that I had to look something up about this particular person. So don't think it's don't make it a habit. I don't, most of the time I'm extemporaneous, but in this particular case, I was not familiar with him. But you know,
well,
the
thing is, there's
only a small percentage of these extremist jihadists in the whole world, Muslim world. So why do people need to be afraid of them? Is my question. It's ridiculous.
Well,
this is ridiculous.
Because about 100 to 1,000 of them have guns and they chop people's head off with knives.
So what? That's a couple people. We've got the potential to incorporate, you know, two of the greatest religions that believe in the same things, and
it's never going to happen. Your age of utopia is never going to happen because the sons of Ishmael are opposed to the sons of Isaac, and Muhammad's whole Quran is a apostasy of the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
So Iran is going to bomb the United States off the planet. The planet's going to bomb Iran off the planet, and that's the solution.
No,
and that's
Russia's going to come down through Syria. China's going to come over, and there's going to be a World War III. It's going to apex in Jerusalem, where Jesus will return, tear down the temple, rebuild it, and reign for 1,000 years. John, anytime you want.
All I got to do is ask how's Lauren. you just ran it down. So hey, whatever's happening, it's happening, and this all.
Lauren will die a mortal death if he doesn't accept Christ soon.
And go to work tomorrow.
Yeah, but I think that's a clean timeline, but it's I think a little too precise, and I think those things will happen, but I just don't think they're going to happen quite as laid out as you think. You know, Bible prophecy has a lot of shapes and shadows, and when it comes down to the reality, it shakes out a little bit different than how people plan it. And it's always a surprise. I think it's wonderful, actually, because you just never know. Let me put it this way. What if the end of the world is in 200 years? Because most of us go, oh, it's all good. I mean, since I grew up, my parents thought the end of the world was going to happen. They thought they were going to see Jesus come back, and that's because they didn't invest certain ways. They didn't plan education in certain ways because end of the world was here, and I was raised that way. I didn't go to college because it's like, well, why do I need to? It's like, you know, I just need to share Jesus because the end of the world's coming. I'm 56, and we're still waiting, and I'll probably pass away in a couple generations before it gets to this other level. So the point is, if it's 200 years from now, what do we do in the in-between? You know, like, oh, I need to recycle. I need to deal with people that are militant in other religions. I think what's nice about America is that we do have the freedom to choose our religion, whereas if you have a religious-controlled government, the problem I see, it's not that it's bad, it's to what level do they enforce the law, and what laws do they enforce? In other words, do all women have to wear certain things? You go, okay, that might not be bad. But what if they don't wear those certain things? Do we stone them? Do we cut their hands off? Do we imprison them? Do we, you know, sexually mutilate them, you know, their genitalia? It's like, those are heavy issues. I think, yeah, Western culture is dangerous because of our technology, but what if we didn't have the technology? Would it be that dangerous? You know, I mean, if these other religions had the technology, would they be polluting the planet just as much as us? You know, I mean, all that oil is coming from the Middle East. It's not coming from, from the other places as much. They're polluting the planet just as by selling it. How you like them?
I'm looking up an archive. I'm looking up an archive that I'm going to play. So, the thing is, you know, we have a lot of this stuff we don't have any control over, but ISIS has the centerpiece attention of the world. Everybody names it, even in the presidential race, as the number one enemy, the number one thing that we have to wipe out. But unless we understand the origins.
And that's, And that's why they do this stuff, is to get everyone's attention. You know, so in a way, it's like we're allowing them to be successful. I don't know. I wouldn't mind if the candidates said, you know, this next thing, we're not going to give them the power they're seeking. So we're not even going to mention them for one, you know, meet or in the news. We're just not going to report anything about them. We're just going to bleep it all out because that's all they're looking for is a headline, you know. And they're desperate to do that. They don't have real power, as Don was saying. They're not significant.
Yeah, go ahead, Don, with your next comment.
I
actually have a ghost caller in. Would you guys like to hear the ghost caller?
Yeah, because for the most part,
but what can they really do about violent extreme religious groups, Bob?
Well, I want to comment on Obama's lack of leadership in the Syrian situation. What's really going on, in my opinion, is that the Israelis have a tremendous amount of influence in our government, in our foreign policy, in our military decisions. The Jewish-Israeli pact, PAC, that has a tremendous amount of control, and Israel wants to see Assad remain in power in Syria.
That was our ghost caller. John, don't beat me up.
What are you talking about? I'm interested in what he had to
John,
say because he's on the right. He's on the right track.
John, care
Obama.
To comment?
We used to have a co-host on the show, and between him and Jane, they had a certain difference of opinions and kind of a social miscommunication. And so basically he wanted off the show and just didn't want to, but in a way, he didn't want to communicate that. Like, he didn't want to talk it out or work out. He just like, I'm done. Don't call me. Leave me alone. And so it was kind of counter to the policy of Jane, who likes to talk things through and work things out. So it kind of became a situation of, please don't stalk me. Please don't call me. Please don't interact. And he interpreted a lot of things that way. So part of the deal is.
And basically, the only reason I played it tonight is because John, a year ago, John, me, and Bob did a show on when they did the Boko Haram did those horrible killings in Nigeria and killed the Christians. And then 61 Christians in Syria were killed, I think, either in a classroom or a village. So I just wanted to play that clip kind of like as a throwback Thursday because it's the end of the year and, you know, at the end of the year, you think about things that you don't normally think about.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a recap. So part of, like, I keep in contact with the aforementioned person. And part of the deal I do is I just don't talk about Jane. And when I'm talking to Jane, I don't talk to Jane about the aforementioned person. But it's cool. Like it's not some super breach of protocol or of promise or anything. I just try to keep, because I like to keep.
It's water under the bridge. The dust is settled.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I like to keep friendly with all parties. So some people, you know, there's certain unmentionable treaties.
Wrap it up,
in my
John.
Case, I'm flexible.
We only have 15
well,
minutes
yeah.
left.
Because I'm interested.
Basically,
in
he was a former co-host.
But.
No.
I'm interested in Khatib and what he did until he was murdered,
dead.
Until he was executed. Yeah.
The thing was is that Khatib had to pay a high price for even just standing his ground because in the end he was hung. He was
right.
hung for a crime that he probably did not do.
He wasn't
stirring a pot. He was just making a point that leaders should not just always, you know, He wanted to establish Sharia law, which is probably unrealistic at the time, but the fact of the matter is he did have to pay a high price for his beliefs. Go ahead, Don.
Mm. No. I was just wondering the high price for what he did. He wanted to just express some of the things that the Islamic state should keep in mind. And for him to proselytize like that, he was angry. And you can see the anger in everybody of color, everybody who's got the Muslim, the garb on, every place they go, they're excoriated. We got two more mosques in Southern California today that were written on.
Vandalized?
And defaced and vandalized, right. We've got one here in Nevada. You know, we've got these things that are popping up even more. You know, this is something that people, and I'll call them my oppressor, you know, they need to look at themselves in the mirror and really, you know, this caller was right about the Israelis and Obama in that the need to maintain Assad's position. That's why I wanted to really hear what he said. But
I could play a couple more minutes. I'll play two more minutes, but I want to preface this by saying one thing. Throughout Muslim history, Muslim-dominated countries, we've only seen two kinds of government. Puppet states like Mubarak in Egypt, which lasted 30 years successfully with the U.S., that everything was swept under the rug and real issues weren't dealt with, but not a lot of people died. Or extreme Islamic takeovers like Saddam Hussein, who would wipe out people at a drop of the hat if they didn't comply. So generally speaking, only Jordan, Israel, and a few other countries like Lebanon have had moderate success. Lebanon has a blend of Christian, Muslim, and Jews. And well, let's just go with more of Bob's comments. Let's go.
Israel absolutely wants to see Assad remain in power because he has, as long as he's been in power, going back, you know, many, many years, there's been no conflict, no fighting between Syria and Israel.
Well, did you know that that Bashar al-Assad protects minority religions, like certain Christian factions? There's another minority. He's from a minority religion. I have to look it up now. But he's actually from the Alawites. And I think some Jews were protected under his regime, if I'm not mistaken.
Besides the Jews, there are also a group called the Druze, D-R-U-S-E, Sunni and Shia. There's several different types of Christian groups. You know, Syria is the country in the Near East that has the most diversity of ethnic groups and of religions. And it's always been this way for a very long time.
They also have that one group that's not popular that people consider outcasts. I'm going to look it up here quick. But you know what? Then why did they go and occupy Lebanon for 10 years if they're so diverse? Did you know that they occupied Lebanon for 10 years?
Yes, they occupied a fair amount.
John's call dropped, Don. I'm not sure why.
Okay. Well, I don't know why. He was in transit, so the only thing I can think of is that he went under a bridge somewhere or whatever. But, that was an interesting philosophy that I guess Bob was espousing, so that was kind of neat. But anyway, so what else is going on? How are you today?
I guess I was going to read one thing about Ketub. One second here.
Go ahead. Because
I hope
this
John
is
didn't
kinda...
drop. Just a second, please.
because...
Well, John can't call back in now because it's after...
It's after the...
I was going to say that Kitub was released from prison, you know, and then in 1964, and then he was rearrested for a potential
assassination.
Yeah, and then he was hung in 1966, and he was 60 years old by then, because he was born in 1906. But alongside notable Islamists like Maloney Madudi, Hassan Banna, and Ruhollah Khomeini, Kitub is considered one of the most influential Muslim thinkers or activists of the modern era.
Right.
And many thought he died a martyr's death.
Right. And most everybody, Hussein, you mentioned, and Hosni Mubarak, they followed his teachings religiously, so to speak. And so he's, he's been revered and modernized, as you said, martyrized, as you said. And, is that a good thing or a bad thing? He's brought on awareness that we have not, like Donald Trump, we haven't seen in a long time. So, there's a possibility that some of the things he's done or his teachings have done is raise awareness of the plight of those who are have-nots. The people who are have-nots.
Yeah, it says his legacy is extends to issues such as westernization, modernization, the clash of civilizations east-west, the transnational ummah, which probably has to do something with breaking sacredness, and jihad. Now, John could technically call back in on my home phone. So let's see if we can... I'm going to try to get him. Could you talk a minute while I try to get him so he can do a conclusion?
All right, because for the most part, I was just going to say we're running out of time. But, yeah, that's no problem.
I don't have his number memorized, though. Go ahead.
All right, but, you've got to remember that he had a utopian vision. He wanted to see a world that was beautiful and free and righteous and just. And he was taught here in the United States. And he saw firsthand some of the things that could revile most people today. That's why political correctness is so in vogue, because these things, they want to sweep issues under the rug. But I don't understand some of the white citizen civilization's thoughts. So I can understand some of the things.
I can understand the angst, because when I was growing up in America, I felt plagued by the corporate mentality, and I wasn't even in it. But until I started my first day of work, I didn't really know what it was like to earn an honest day's living. I was still a socialist by the time I finished college, but I still think that a lot of the angst that young people have, especially heavy thoughtful intellectuals, they just can't accept the world at face value with all the discrepancies in it. And that a certain power structure.
But and you've hit the nail on the head. We are human beings. We learn and live by feeling, by vibes, by intellect, by using intuition and deduction. That's how we survive. We wouldn't live 10 days if we couldn't do that. And
John's on the air with us now.
Okay, well, we automatically have a instinct to hate something that we don't even know. And when you were mentioning that we were kids, because I felt the same way, and I'm sure a million, billion other kids did, that the corporate oligarchical method of democracy, if you will, was not going to work. And lo and behold, you see our cities today, they're all crumbling. White flight has left entire cities blighted. And this is not anybody's fault, but those who led us here. And Obama's only had 6 years. Everybody has 7 years. So everybody else had the entire American landscape to pretty much destroy what they created. Go ahead, John.
We only have time for a conclusion now. John, you're on the air. Did you have any resentment growing up like Saeed Qutob about the power structure and who makes decisions?
Can't hear him. Can't hear
him. Can you talk a little louder, John?
Or can you be a little clearer? I think... No. It's not happening.
Summarize for John, because John can't hear well. He basically said that, he's accepting of things, but today is a good day to die. Just don't give out your address again. And John, we only have 3 minutes left, so I heard what you said about bad decisions or something, but I couldn't translate it. But you'll have to call back in next week. I'll touch base with you earlier in the week about our other issue. Okay, John? Okay. Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Sorry about that. I was trying to hold up two phones together.
I know. So, it really didn't work. I didn't hear anything until the very end, but that was a good try.
That's because I was holding the wrong part of the phone in. So
okay.
I guess the one thing that my conclusion is I watched this CNN special called In the Footsteps of Bin Laden, where he would go out in the desert with very little comforts. Bin Laden was influenced by Saeed Qutob, and he would go out in the desert for long periods of like fasting and soul searching and learning techniques of survival. And he was preparing for a bigger war and a bigger battle. Now, why they're targeting millions of Westerners and thinking they can win, it does seem unrealistic to me because they seem to be against a lot of things. They have to realize that people grew up in different cultures.
Well, you're missing it right now. They're for a lot of things. You got to look at the glass half full or half empty. They're looking for a more peaceful life.
Well, then why can't they be like Rastafarians who worshipped Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, from 1930 to 1974, and smoke weed and the roots of that church and movement came from the Ethiopian Christian movement and the Coptic Church of Alexandria. I mean, why can't we be Rastafarians, not jihadists?
The Rastafarians, for the most part, are black. Muslim, Islam are every shade under the sun. As I read, our president was raised in a Muslim educational environment in Indonesia. He cannot even say radical Islamism. And so we are dealing with a whole new animal here, which is one of the reasons that Qutob can pretty much stay dead, and we have to get ready to incorporate at least 80,000 to 100,000 refugees.